top stories. Washington rejects Ukraine president's request for a no-fly zone for Russian flights, saying it would lead to direct confrontation with Russia, which the U.S. does not want. Russia gives stern warning to suppliers of lethal weapons to Ukraine, saying they will be held responsible if those weapons are used against the Russian military. And Iran warns the U.S. against, quote, bluffs and blusters in the JCPOA revival talks, saying Tehran will not wait forever for an agreement to be reached. Thank you for joining us. The U.S. rejects Kiev's request for a no-fly zone for Russian aircraft over Ukraine, saying participation in such a move would be tantamount to a direct conflict with Moscow. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki says implementing a no-fly zone would be a step towards sending U.S. troops to fight Russia, which Washington does not want. This after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged the West to do more to help Ukraine, as heavy fighting is underway in the country's second-largest city, Kharkiv. The Ukraine president also called for an international tribunal to look into what he describes as Russia's war crimes against his country. He said Russia has so far launched around 60 rocket strikes and fired over 110 cruise missiles into Ukraine. Meanwhile, Ukraine's army claims it has slowed down the pace of Russia's advance.
The Russian occupiers have slowed down the offensive, but are still trying to build on success in some areas in the offensive against Ukraine. During the air offensive, the enemy continued to fire on military and civilian airfields, military control points, air defense facilities, important critical infrastructure, settlements, and units in defense areas.
The Ukrainian military has accused Russia of launching a missile strike on residential buildings in two cities in the country's northwest and north. Meanwhile, Ukraine's health ministry has put the number of civilian casualties at 352, including 16 children. According to the ministry, over 1,600 people have also been wounded over the past 4 days. The UN Refugee Agency says over 500,000 people have fled from Ukraine into neighboring countries, with Poland and Moldova receiving the largest group of refugees. Russia has closed its airspace to airlines from dozens of countries in response to sanctions targeting its aviation sector. All 27 European Union nations, as well as Britain and Canada, are among the 36 countries barred from using the Russian airspace. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has canceled a trip to the United Nations office in Geneva due to the airspace ban imposed by several EU countries. The Russian Foreign Ministry says the steps the European Union has taken against Moscow will not go without a harsh response. It added that those supplying lethal weapons to Ukraine will bear responsibility should they be used during Russia's military campaign there. Meanwhile, China has declared its opposition to anti-Russia sanctions.
China's position on the Ukraine issue is consistent. China always decides its position and policy based on the merits of the matter. China does not approve the use of sanctions to solve problems, and even more opposed to unilateral sanctions that have no basis in international law. Practice has long proven that sanctions will not solve problems, but create new ones. This will not only result in a lose-lose or losing all-side situation in the economy, but also interfere with the process of political settlement.
The Chinese official said his country's relationship with Russia has not targeted any third country. He stressed that Beijing and Moscow remain strategic partners. Russia has been targeted by several rounds of Western sanctions over its military offensive in Ukraine. The bans mainly target Russia's bank and economic sector, as well as individuals, including President Vladimir Putin. The UK says Western sanctions are designed to topple Putin, but the West does not seek anything in terms of regime change. Moscow says it is able to ride out the sanctions. In its latest anti-Moscow move, Washington has expelled 12 Russian diplomats at the United Nations, labeling them as intelligence operatives. Russia's UN ambassador says Moscow will respond to the move because, quote, it's diplomatic practice. The European Union has announced it intends to ban Russian media, Russia Today and Sputnik, as part of its tough sanctions package against Moscow. Brussels has accused the outlets of spreading Russian propaganda, but the move is seen by some observers as an attack on the freedom of speech and censorship. Amina Taylor has more from the British capital.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine, the state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy. And that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine. These kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time, but observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
In a phone call with his French counterpart, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has set out several conditions for the resolution of the conflict with Ukraine. According to a Kremlin readout, Putin said Kiev should be neutral, denazified, and demilitarized, and that Russia's control over Crimea should be formally recognized. The Russian leader said Moscow is open to talks with representatives of Ukraine and expects the negotiations to lead to the desired results. In turn, Emmanuel Macron reiterated the international community's demand that Russia halt its offensive in Ukraine. Macron also urged Putin to stop all strikes on civilians, preserve civilian infrastructure, and provide safe access to key roads, especially south of Kiev. According to the LEC Palace, Putin confirmed his willingness to commit on these three points. Iran says a deal is at hand if Washington makes up its mind about remaining issues in the ongoing talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA. Spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says Iran is willing to reach an agreement, but it will not wait forever. The comment is a reaction to remarks by U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price that Washington is prepared to walk away from the talks in Vienna if Tehran displays intransigence.
We are prepared to walk away if Iran displays an intransigence to making progress. But let me be clear that walking away won't mean leaving the status quo. We have talked about the alternatives, at least in general terms, the alternatives that we have developed and we are prepared to pursue together with our allies and partners if the Iranians are unwilling to engage in good faith, in a constructive way, on the remaining outstanding issues.
The spokesman didn't detail those alternatives. The U.S. pulled out of the pact in 2018 and reimposed sanctions that led Iran to reduce its nuclear commitments as stipulated in the 2015 deal. Parties involved in the Vienna talks say progress has been made toward the restoration of the pact. But Iran says the U.S. needs a political decision to meet Tehran's remaining demands, including guarantees that the United States will not quit the pact again. Iran also wants the sanctions to be removed in a verifiable manner. The U.S. is violating all international norms and rights while pretending to be the global policeman. This is according to the Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights. Qasem Gharibabadi says the international community must stand up to such illegal and illegitimate measures. Gharibabadi was addressing the 49th regular session of the Human Rights Council in Geneva. Iran's top human rights official described the U.S. resource or the U.S. recourse to unilateral coercive measures as an attempt to impose its own will on other states. He said sanctions have blocked Iran's access to essential medicines and medical supplies and prevented the delivery of humanitarian aid to the country during natural disasters and the COVID-19 pandemic. He said sanctions must be seen as a means of aggression and a crime against humanity. Afghan capital Kabul has hosted a ceremony to commemorate Eid al-Mab'ath, an occasion marking the appointment of Muhammad bin Abdullah as the Prophet of Islam in the 7th century. Participants in the ceremony called on the Islamic countries to get united and resist against arrogant powers. Rahmatullah Baghwan has more.
Afghans gathered to celebrate Eid al-Mab'ath, an important day in the history of Islam on which the Prophet Muhammad was chosen as God's final messenger and started his prophetic mission. Participants paid tribute to the Grand Prophet of Islam and congratulated Muslims around the globe on this holy occasion.
I congratulate all Muslims worldwide on the anniversary of the Grand Eid al-Mab'ath. Prophet Muhammad was appointed as a messenger to enlighten the world and instruct people how to live. He taught us not to accept slavery and live freely. Afghans have proved that if we follow Islam, no one can defeat us.
Prophet Muhammad as the final messenger of God has been the best role model for humankind. He had the best personality and attributes. Prophet Muhammad says that he was sent to teach moral virtues to humanity. He serves as a teacher and as a savior for all Muslims and humanity.
Addressing the ceremony, speakers also emphasized the need for Islamic unity among all Muslims. They said one of the messages of the Prophet of Islam was to fight oppression, injustice, and devils.
We Muslim nations are obliged to follow Prophet Muhammad's path and study his teachings and thoughts. One of his messages to us is to get united. Second, he asked us to resist against devils, oppressors, and arrogant powers. That is when we will succeed.
Tuesday marks the anniversary of the beginning of the prophetic mission of Muhammad Rasulullah. Eid al-Mab'ath is largely commemorated by the followers of Islam around the globe. As a Muslim nation, Afghans take this opportunity to strengthen the bonds of brotherhood and solidarity. They say the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was a messenger of kindness, peace, and justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Against the backdrop of rising Islamophobia around the world in recent decades, efforts are being made by Muslim leaders to counter a hostile narrative against the Islamic faith perpetuated by liberal politicians and the mainstream media. A case in point, a recent book authored by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, on the life of the Prophet Muhammad for readers around the world. From London, Saeed Purrazzo reports on the launching of the English version of the book on the anniversary of Prophet Muhammad's appointment to prophetic mission.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us, we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the Word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism. Because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam, that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions.
At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saeed Purizup, London.
Well, with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As the month of Ramadan approaches, all the conditions for another explosion are still in place, says Awad Abdul Fattah Ryder in an article published under the heading, Why Sheikh Jarrah and Al-Aqsa Could Ignite a New Intifada. Stay tuned for more. On February 14th, Haaretz published an article with the headline, The East Jerusalem Flashpoint That Could Ignite the Entire Middle East. In it, the journalist Nir Hassoun wrote, Sheikh Jarrah had, again, become the site of violent clashes, just as it did before last year's war. Other Israelis cited similar concerns. The Zionist regime's prime minister, Naftali Bennett, himself a right-wing settler, warned far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gvir, who earlier this month set up a makeshift parliamentary office in a tent on Palestinian land in Sheikh Jarrah, that his actions could cause chaos. Bennett on February 14th said, "We don't need provocations from people on either side inflaming tensions for political interest." Given the latest raid by the Zionist settlers on the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah and the violent clashes with its Palestinian inhabitants that followed, the Zionist regime's officials and media's concerns about replicating last May's almost unprecedented Palestinian uprising do not seem far-fetched. As Ramadan approaches once again, beginning at the start of April, there is a huge potential for conflict to erupt around possible Zionist restrictions on Palestinian access to parts of the Old City and Al-Aqsa Mosque during the Muslim Holy Month. Ben-Gvir's act in Sheikh Jarrah, where 27 families have been fighting eviction since 2008, led to violent clashes between the Palestinian families and their supporters and the Zionist regime's security forces. Several protesters were injured while others were arrested. It is this strong resistance by the Palestinian families to the recent assaults by the settlers that has caused Israeli alarm, especially since this renewed local resistance has also brought pressure from Al-Quds-based international diplomats. In the past few months, some Israeli circles held the belief that the popular resistance in Sheikh Jarrah had been exhausted by a number of factors, including the continued Israeli siege of the neighborhood. But the Zionist regime's apparent desire to avoid further confrontation with Palestinians doesn't stem from humanitarian reasons, and Bennett's criticism of Ben-Gvir's provocative conduct is not because the prime minister is any less extreme or aggressive about denying the Palestinian right to self-determination. Rather, it is because, firstly, Bennett sees Ben-Gvir's behavior as directed against his cabinet as part of his infighting within the settlers' camp, split as it is over former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the corruption charges he's facing. Secondly, Bennett is not interested in any disruptions that might embarrass his new allies. For Bennett, especially on the Arab and international scene, things seem to be going pretty well. On the domestic front, he's determined to fight off continued attempts from the right-wing opposition to bring his government down. So the Palestinians are paying the price twice, firstly from the ongoing and brutal settler colonial ethnic cleansing project, secondly from infighting between the two camps over whoever can be more brutal in implementing the cleansing plans. Last year, almost no one had been expecting scenes of the popular uprising like the ones we witnessed in East Al-Quds, especially centered around one small neighborhood. It was thought impossible that Palestinian resistance could overcome the huge obstacles that have been placed before it physically, with the high separation walls that had been erected, making it difficult to unite Palestinians in one fighting front, and politically, with the security cooperation with the Israeli colonizer. That doesn't mean we will necessarily see another intifada of the same scope and intensify during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan, even though all of the conditions for another explosion are still in place. It could happen before Ramadan, or it could be months or years from now. But one thing is certain. As long as the apartheid settler colonial regime of Israel continues with its injustices, brutalities, and atrocities, the Palestinian people will continue to resist. In recent years, we've seen the emergence of a young generation, creative and brilliant at organizing. They are skilled in using social media to overcome geographic and social fragmentation and reaching out to all Palestinians, wherever they are, as well as to the world. These young people have decided not to wait for traditional leadership to save them, as it has proven incompetent. The birthing of a new leadership is underway. This will take years and will require much endeavor and sacrifice, but that's what the future holds for them, with no other savior in sight. The many minor uprisings, which are led by the youth, are the driving force behind the human rights organizations framing the Zionist regime as an apartheid regime. The Israeli apartheid regime might have a strong relations economically and in terms of security with world regimes. But global civil society is undergoing a significant opinion shift against the fake regime of Israel. At every popular intifada, with every military deployment against Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime comes under fire from global civil society organizations. This is what disturbs the Israeli regime. The Palestinians, and especially the young activists, are confident that the South African moment is coming sooner or later. This hope is what fuels their passion in the struggle for a free Palestine, where justice and equality can prevail on the ruins of the immoral and inhuman settler colonial entity.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us listen to a thought-provoking saying from the Holy Prophet's seventh infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him. For the steadfast, a misfortune is only one, while it is twofold for the impatient.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We are looking at human rights, and specifically justice being the core of human rights. And we are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Now, previously we mentioned that Amir al-Mu'mineen, he constantly emphasized on the fact that people need to raise their concerns and speak out their minds and show their displeasure with their kings and rulers and ruling powers and governments and kings and presidents, to show that they are not content, not happy, their rights are not being given to them. So in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen, being annoyed at a cruelty and oppression was in fact an important thing. It's not just a secondary or a recommended action or act. In fact, it's vital that we rise up. And especially when it comes to, you know, welcoming, if we want to welcome equity and justice, it is an important thing to have, to be awake, to be aware, to fight, to realize where we are. And most of the times, at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen and even at our time, we are living as what we refer to in the Matrix, as we have seen in the movie, that people are just turned into batteries. People are turned into machines. They just, you know, the kings and the rulers and the governments, they're just taking everything from us and not giving us anything back. And we are under a sleeping pill. We need to wake up. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he said, no, oppression and cruelty is something that people need to be annoyed with. They need to express their minds and they need to speak out. In return, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he respected the personal freedom of the individuals, and also kept in his view the right of the nation, which is ultimately that's what it should be, that leaders and rulers, that's what they should do. This is what Amir al-Mu'mineen, he himself did, respected the personal freedom of the individuals and kept the rights of the nation. That's what we need from these leaders and rulers and presidents. We need them to give us our freedoms and also the rights of the nations. Now, if you look at a comparison between the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen and what happened to him and now, you can draw the conclusion as well. As regards to those who did not give or did not take the oath of allegiance to Amir al-Mu'mineen, he said to them clearly and plainly, it does not matter if they do not take the oath of allegiance. I don't care if they don't take it. If they don't want to give it to me, by all means. But in return, however, he said, however, they should stay indoors and should not interfere in the affairs of the nation. That sometimes you see people say, you know what, I don't want to vote, I don't want to elect, I don't want to do anything. By all means, you have the right. But don't come later on and criticize and speak about the governments that took power that you were not part of making. That's a very crucial point. Now, before we go any further, let us take a break and then we will continue.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So just before the break, we said that Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he assumed Khilafah and leadership, he made a statement. He said, people who do not want to give oath of allegiance, by all means, in return, they should not interfere with me when I try to establish justice and try to give people their rights. Now, I said we can draw the conclusion between Amir al-Mu'mineen's time and our time, that we see that today, when we go to elections and we elect the governments and the presidents and prime ministers and the cabinets and ministers, we elect them. Some of us, some we say, I don't want to elect, I don't care about this. But once these people become in power and they become oppressors and what have you, you saw those who outcasted themselves, those who stayed away from being involved in the system, they are the ones who are talking and criticizing and what have you. All we get to say to them is the same thing Amir al-Mu'mineen did. Since he did not take part into shaping your freedom and the freedom of people, you should stay away from it. Give you examples. One of the people that did not give allegiance to Amir al-Mu'mineen was Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, who was a member of the consultative council who denied to take an oath of allegiance to Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, did not compel him, did not force him to take the oath, and he let him free. I mean, as we know, this is the justice of Ali alayhi as-salam. Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, in return, he said, you do not need to feel worried about me. I shall never rise against you, which is obviously a very fair statement. And this is what was required of him. Amir al-Mu'mineen said, I will not force anyone, but don't you dare come and raise against me once, or rise against me when I assume position. So that was one of the characters that happened. Also, we have Abdullah ibn Umar, the son of Umar himself. He also did not take allegiance and did not give the oath to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam asked him to produce a guarantor who should guarantee that he would not create any disturbance. But Abdullah ibn Umar declined to do so. Thereupon, Amir al-Mu'mineen said to him, you have been ill-mannered since your childhood, and I know you from the very first day. Well, obviously, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he knew him before he was born. And so he said to him, you need to bring a guarantor to guarantee that you're not going to create any mischief. Abdullah ibn Umar denied that, which means, no, I will do as I please, and I still won't give you my allegiance, which was going against the Khalifa of his time. The Amir al-Mu'mineen said to him, well, what can I say to you? You this is how you were from day one. You were an ill-mannered child. And then the Amir al-Mu'mineen said, salamullah alayhi, he said to him, leave him as well. I guarantee that he will not create any disturbance. Now, what else can Amir al-Mu'mineen do? And people wanted to say, well, okay, let's do something about him. He says, no, leave him be. I will become his guarantor. So the idea is, when it comes to justice, you need to be involved. If you don't want to be involved, don't come again or later and rise against those who are trying to apply it. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Cultural news.
Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
Hello everyone and welcome to Delight. Let's begin with an artistic spirit. Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoch, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Gogh's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings. An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. It is now well-established facts that animals feel, think, behave, and even experience pain. Thus, they should be treated with the same respect as humans, while a center in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is doing the same. Life-saving services to injured apes. The sanctuary, located in a vast national park, has been active for two decades. The center houses scores of chimpanzees, gorillas, and endangered great apes. Bonobos and bonobos as well. Most of the animals that are brought to the sanctuary were rescued from poachers. The staff there provide medical care to the injured animals until they are healthy enough to be integrated into a group of their fellow species.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbe Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It's fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf. Last but not least, the 16th Fajr International Poetry Festival has wrapped up with an award ceremony in Tehran. The literary event aims to honor Persian poets from Iran and the world with the ultimate goal of elevating Persian poetry. Yusuf Jalali has more.
an occasion to honor poets and poetry. The 16th edition of Fajr International Poetry Festival saw its closing ceremony in Tehran, where the best Persian poetry works of the year were acknowledged and awarded. During the event, participants from Iran and other countries contended in different categories, including classic poetry, modern poetry, and children and young adults.
I won the prize for the best poetry book for children and young adults. My book is titled Silence in the Mother Tongue. I'm so glad that my effort is seen, judged, and acknowledged by top Iranian literary personalities from the jury of the festival.
Certainly, Fajr Poetry Festival is of great significance to me as an Afghan poet. Here, literary experts from Iran, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the world can network and make joint efforts to promote the Persian language.
Iran is known as the land of poets, being home to many world-renowned literary figures over the centuries, including Rumi, Hafez, and Khayyam. Experts here believe Persian poetry has no expiry date, and not only do Iranians still read ancient poems, they're also interested in modern prose and poetry.
Poetry is a beautiful language that speaks the beauty of the world, and such a language always communicates very well with the hearts of human beings. Iranians have long understood the beauty of this language and still listen to it and read it in its every form and genre.
Fajr International Poetry Festival was launched in 2006 as a platform for Persian poets from Iran and other Persian-speaking countries to get together for the elevation of Persian poetry. However, the literary event has grown to encompass non-Persian poets who are interested in Iranian literature.
Poetry holds a special position among Iranians, and you can rarely find an Iranian family that doesn't have a poetry book in their bookshelves. Now, aside from acknowledging Persian literary figures and poets, Fajr Festival seeks to preserve this long-standing culture and introduce it to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Color, beauty, and entertainment. The French city of Nice hosts a dazzling and flashy event. The so-called Battle of the Flowers took place on Saturday. Performers on top of animal-themed floats waved at the crowd and threw flowers at the audience while musicians played live. Each of the 16 floats was decorated with around 3,000 flowers. Also, thousands of people attended the event. The Battle of the Flowers is part of the carnival in Nice, which has been held annually for almost 150 years. An endangered Mediterranean monk seal has embarked on a new solo adventure after spending months under the care of conservationists. Four-month-old Evie was released back into the wild on February 15th in northern Greece. Evie was rescued when she was only 7 days old. She had been washed ashore and separated from her nursing mother during a storm. However, conservationists found the lucky seal and started taking care of her. Even though Evie's health was poor, she recuperated quickly.
She was really dehydrated in the beginning, which is very common with pups that separate from their mothers at such an early age. And the first few weeks were critical for her health because there's basically no way to replenish, to replace the mother's milk. So we have a certain protocol and a food regimen that we provide along with vitamins and other supplements to the seal. And thankfully, in the first few weeks, she showed signs of her health status became better.
The conservationists hope Evie will be able to join a community of her species soon. They will be tracking her movements with a chip. There are only a few hundred Mediterranean monk seals left in the wild. About half of them live in Greece. Entrapment from fishing, pollution, depletion of food, resources, and climate change are some of the threats facing the species.
History shows a gun barrel never stops people from acquiring their learning tools. A bookshop in the besieged Gaza Strip is a testimony as book lovers flooded the store months after it was flattened in an Israeli airstrike. The new Samir Mansour bookshop, funded by an international donor campaign, now stands some 200 meters from its original site. It was destroyed by an Israeli airstrike on the west of Gaza City last year. The new shop is spread across two floors and is stocked with some 400,000 books. They range from school texts to the Quran to Arabic translations of European literary classics. Hundreds of people, including writers and Palestinian officials, attended the bookshop's reopening. The store first opened its doors 30 years ago and is considered the oldest and the biggest in Gaza.
The city of London usually welcomes art and culture from all over the world, including Iran. In our next report, Bianca Rahimi will be taking us to a performance that fuses music from across the East.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Mehsan Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century, performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simurgh.
The Simurgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simurgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert. And I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings. And the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings. So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix of fusion of different music, and that's always interesting. And it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds, and it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, that through things like music and art, there can also be synergy, and things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Axolotls are unique Mexican amphibians at risk of extinction, and many conservation programs are now trying to save these strange-looking animals. An ecological park in Mexico City is the latest place to celebrate them. It has held a ceremony for releasing baby axolotls into their natural habitat, which is the mud. These amphibians are so special that even a number of city officials attended the event. Conservationists say having a clean environment is key to their survival.
I've managed to breed up to 22,000 axolotls. In all of Jasimilco, there are 90 axolotls across 90 kilometers, but the quality of the axolotls depends on the quality of biologist you are. Bad quality water has killed anywhere from 12,000 to 15,000.
Researchers have discovered that axolotls can absorb oxygen from the surface of their skin and are therefore more vulnerable to dirty water and environments. More than 70 breeding centers across Mexico have joined the rally of saving these critically endangered species. Many are even marketing them as ideal pets. But to animal advocates, keeping axolotls as pets is a definite no-no.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Rejecting pressure to terminate the program in its entirety, the Biden administration has recently announced it is redesigning a Trump-era experiment that physicians and progressive lawmakers have criticized as a scheme to fully privatize Medicare. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Critics Blast Biden, Rebrand of Trump's Medicare Privatization Scheme. This is the story. Rejecting pressure to terminate the program in its entirety, the Biden administration has recently announced it is redesigning a Trump-era experiment that physicians and progressive lawmakers have criticized as a scheme to fully privatize Medicare. Instead of ending what's known as the direct contracting model, which the Trump administration officially launched in 2020, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, gave the program a new name, ACO REACH, which stands for Accountable Care Organization Realizing Equity Access and Community Health. In addition to the name change and fresh veneer, a step in line with the healthcare industry's call for a rebranding, CMS said the program will now span 4 years instead of eight and will include requirements aimed at ensuring transparency and equity. The changes are slated to take effect on January 1, 2023. Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP, a doctor-led group that has spearheaded the opposition to direct contracting, was far from satisfied with the Biden administration's changes, which the organization argued are more cosmetic than substantive. Dr. Susan Rogers, an internal medicine physician and president of PNHP, said ACO REACH is direct contracting in disguise. This new model doubles down on direct contracting fatal flaws, inserting a profit-seeking middleman between beneficiaries and their providers. Under direct contracting, so-called direct contracting entities were paid monthly by CMS to cover a specified portion of a patient's medical care. DCs, the majority of which are currently controlled by investors, not health